Internalized capitalism is like, we got to do an extra special training on the something, something, something. And they were like, no, actually, hold space for us. Let access really question that allows us to check in what we're feeling in our bodies and our spirit. And let's be in presence with each other virtually or whatever, however we can. And I think that was a big, like, oh, okay. Like, this is going against my internalized capitalism, which says this isn't hard enough work.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Emergent Strategy Podcast, hosted by the Emergent Strategy Ideation Institute. We are a collective of facilitators, mediators, trainers, and curious human beings interested in how we get in right relationship with change. Today, I will be guiding our interview. I'm Adrian. I am a teacher, facilitator, mediator, and writer with Emergent Strategy Ideation Institute. And just as a reminder, emergent strategy is the way we generate and reshape complex systems and patterns with relatively simple interactions, lots of relationships, lots of being honest with each other. And one of the people that we are partnered with is the BEAM Collective, the Black Emotional and Mental Health Collective. And today's guest is the, I believe, founding director of BEAM. But Yolo created BEAM, and that's how I came to know your work. I came to know you through Moya Bailey, the God. So I'll never forget our first meetings and just being really dazzled by your brilliance and your sweetness and your kindness. And so I'm so excited to have you here today. So my first question is just, how are you right now today?
Well, first, let me say that I am so excited to be here with you. Long before I met you from Moya the God, I heard so many amazing things and so many other folks. So it's really an honor to be able to be in conversation with you like this. How am I feeling today? You know, today has been a day where I have been in practice with the things that I need to help keep myself rooted. And so that—
Okay, like what?
Centering for me. So I have like a very elaborate morning ritual. Like I tell people, I wake up at 7:30. I'm not available till like 9:30 because I need to be able to do all
the things. Right. That's right.
And so,
yes, I'm also in the long morning crew.
You know, and so like, I wake up in the morning, like, you know, I have my flower ritual. I have my altar ritual. I pull my cards. I think we both have a similar deck. I saw you post Threads of Fate, which is one of my favorites right now.
I love that deck. Yeah,
it's a beautiful deck. It's the velvet on the cards. It's just so good.
It's so good.
And so that I pull my cards, I'll do my meditation, do a little vinyasa flow just to get myself centered, right? And that process, when that is not present in my life, even especially when things are difficult, which things are difficult these days, right? I find that it's really difficult to kind of stay centered. But when I put those things in practice, I'm always like, thank you to myself for putting in the work and for connecting and for setting an intention for the day. Like I try to say, how do I want to feel today? What I want to cultivate?
Yes.
And it's really beautiful and powerful because sometimes they'll be reflected in the cards. And then I'll also see, you know, the themes of them fall into during the day. Even when the cards say things like challenge, and I'm like, okay, I want to center.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. How do I center myself in yet another tower day?
Like, I have another deck and it has a shadow card and I'm like, right, shadows and towers and like, you know, trying to like, when I see those cards, really keep myself centered and rooted. So those are kind of like my morning practices. And I feel like my life is teaching me more and more that like the more I put in practice, the more I can feel it in my being, in my spirit. It doesn't mean things are tough, but it gives me a kind of a firmer place to move from in my center, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. It totally makes sense. Right now, I feel in a lot of ways that how people are experiencing this pandemic is directly correlated to how deeply or consistently people are steeped in their practices. So I'm like, if you're super steeped in it, you may be thrown off, but you do have a center that you know how to return to. And I think if you don't have that center to return to right now is is so much more challenging because it really is like being in a hurricane that does not stop. You know, it's just like the conditions are changing rapidly and not necessarily for the better. For most people, the material conditions are getting harder and harder and will continue to get harder. There's no end in sight. So I'm really like grateful for places like Beam that are attending to, our mental and emotional well-being matter all the time, every day, right now. And there's practices, there's community, there's things available that can actually support you. And every time I think about the work that Beam is doing, I'm like, oh, gosh, I wish our ancestors had had Beam. And I wish that, you know, our enslaved ancestors had Beam. And I wish that every Black person I knew had access. So we at Emergent Strategy Ideation Institute kind of have a crush on Beam. And we think that the way you've been growing the work and pulling together networks of different kinds of experts to meet a variety of Black community needs, it feels to us like the interdependence element of emergent strategy. So first we wanted to say, do you accept that premise? Like, do you see yourself and this project as emergent strategy work?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I love that you talked about the concept of interdependence and how that can mm-hmm. I often also quote you, and some of my colleagues probably like, yes, we know, YOLO, we're moving at the speed of trust. No.
Which, you know what's so funny about that? Because I started to see stuff now that's like, Adrian said that. I'm like, no, I'm quoting Mervin Marcano
when I say it.
Yes, I quote Mervin Marcano. And then there's a lot of other people who have said something similar. And I'm like, oh, this is how this happens. It's like, mm-hmm. even if something is quoted, right? It's like, people are just like, oh no, it's in Adrian's book. So I'm like starting to really pay attention. I'm like, oh, how do I do this? But it is my deepest belief for groups in motion. And it feels like y'all are moving at the speed of trust. So what does that look like for y'all?
Yeah, well, being transparent that, like, you know, it hasn't always been at the speed of trust. You know, we mm-hmm. kind of like sit at this really interesting apex. And one thing I want to name too that you lifted up is about, you know, our ancestors, our enslaved ancestors really having access to spaces like Beam. And I really believe that there were those spaces, those corners.
Oh, talk about it.
Those
yes.
corners and those, like, you know, places in the fields, those little shacks we had to go off to, wherever we created spaces, circles. And so really see Beam as just like one of many, because there's so many amazing institutions and organizations and collectives doing work that is just really trying to reclaim that legacy of healing, refine and uplift it. Because I feel like a big part of mm-hmm. my hope for work in the world is that, you know, we have so many skills and tools and strategies as healers, as Black folks, but they've been so very dismissed, denied, you know, stigmatized. And my hope is like, how can we unearth that more, you know, bring it to the forefront? How can we unearth it and like really sit them up high where they belong in our hearts and our spirits and our minds, you know? I think about that.
Yes. Well, I accept that historical corrective medicine, you know, I think of it as Beam is something that I recommend to people who don't have community, right? Or who don't have community that has what they need. And I come across a lot of people like that. They're like, well, where would I find someone like that? And I'm like, you could go look at Beam. You could go see what programming they're doing, or you can look in their network and find somebody. Like, that's what I was talking about. Is I'm like, if you were living on the right place or whatever, and there was a healer mama, healer somebody around you, great. But at the time, you know, it's like, if you don't know, or if you don't have someone around who's willing to take the risk to heal others, to offer that space, to create the circle,
first
right?
First of all, where you just drop casually, take the risk to heal, to help support healing other folks, okay?
Because it is a risk, right? It's such a risk. Ooh. Like all the healers I know, I'm like, there's that moment where you're like, I think there's something available in me that channels the universe's desire to heal itself. And it's a risk because it doesn't go with most of what we're taught, many of us.
And it's so interesting too, because sometimes people will say, sometimes there are things that come through me that I'm just like, that really wasn't me, but I'm glad, like, you know, I'm glad it was helpful for you. Like, I'm very
all
clear
the time,
because I feel very clear that like I'm channeling some things. And I think the thing they have to be careful when you're channeling and communicating is that you know, you are a channel, so that means there's mud and gunk in you. And like they kind of sometimes discolor or disorient some of the messaging. And so really doing the work of like, okay, this is my gunk. Like sussing that out is a elaborate, complicated, sometimes not clear route to do. And so like, so I think that, but I always trying to pay homage to, you know, the ancestors, the people, the spirits in my lives that I know that make my existence in this world and the way it is possible, the existence of so many healers, the existence of the work we do possible, because it's built on all of that, you know, and so many seen and known and unknown, right? It's many folks,
right?
Many
mamas, we are guided
that we don't, that we don't never know, you know, so just holding that,
So, you know, as we time travel and as we know that we're being held in the arms of our ancestors in this work, can you tell me, where did Beam come from? Like, was it some, did you channel that? Did you wake up one day and know? Was it requested? Like, tell me the origin of it.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. Like, I worked in public health and in community health, and I make the distinction because I think public health institutions tend to come from a very white supremacist kind of framework of engaging wellness or community, right? Versus community health, which I think is led by us.
Yeah.
And you know what? I think it really happened when I was living in New York. I was realizing I was working at NYU at the time in the pediatric infectious disease department. And at that point, I had done a lot of work in different community spaces, grassroots spaces. And I just felt like there were all these gaps. And I felt like there were like big gaps that I was like, ooh, this feels like, and it was like aching in me, the gaps in terms of that space. And I didn't know how to really, I kept remembering trying to like formulate what an institution or an entity or something that could hold those gaps would look like. And there were many early drafts that I was like, that's not it. That's not it. Like, you know what I mean? Just kept trying to give birth to it. But I knew that it had to speak to, it had to speak to mental health, it had to speak to wellness, and it had to speak to it in an embodied practice way. Like it had to really be like, what does this look like? And also be really hypercritical of the medical industrial complex and some of those strategies, while also holding the usefulness of some of that. And then also like, you know, crafting space, which for me, I think the biggest part of what Beam sits in is a tension that I kind of feel like I live in. It's like the tension between Black communities that are kind of liberal, a little bit more centered, and the radical left, right? Sitting in that center and being like, okay, we're going to hold space for us to kind of coexist and struggle together with these frameworks, right?
That's right.
And so I really want to create an institution to kind of like to reflect that. And, you know, it's funny the way it came out. Beam really came together after a really, really difficult time in my life. And I'll never forget, I have been blessed with the tools and community to support me with transmuting some of the most difficult periods of my life into periods in which I could transform, grow, use that compost to actually transform myself and who I am in my world, right? And
that's
so, I'm so grateful now, and I want to be very clear that's because of community, that's because of tools, it's because of support that was possible for me.
Yeah.
And in those moments, what happened, I'll never forget, after that moment, I was really thinking about it's time for me to give, you know, birth to this concept of trying to bring this into the world. And I kept thinking about title story. And I'll never forget, every time I tell a story, I see the images in my head. I have notepads out and I'm writing out Black emotional, Black mental, spirit healing. Blah, blah, blah. I'm trying to figure out what is the name? Because naming is very important to me to start calling something in. And then I started writing Black emotional and mental health. And I was like, oh, that's cute. That's interesting, huh? And I was like, oh, it's like an acronym. It could be BEAM. And I was like, oh, wait, it could be Beam, like a ray of light. And then and there was something in my spirit that said, no, that's Beam as in Joseph Beam too.
Oh, wow.
And so it was really like, it was one of those moments, you know, if you ever have those moments when you kind of like something comes to you and you're like, ooh, that came through, and it kind of shivers you a little bit.
Love the shiver.
And because Joseph Beam is just a pivotal character in my own development in my life.
That's right. Tell us a story.
Whose work really paved the pathway for me. You know, I still remember being in an Atlanta bookstore somewhere in Grant Park. And when I found Brother to Brother, I was like, this existed. There were Black men who were talking about feminism and like, you know, and talking about openly about HIV and depression. And that just not a part of my reality. And so in some ways, in that stage of my journey, they gave birth to a permission for me to exist, because I felt like I was in Atlanta in this hyper-Christian, you know, space as a very witchy person, like, you know what I mean? Very much so in a community of lesbian and queer women, and in a place where most of the gay men community at that time were really, you know, misogynistic and transphobic.
Yeah.
So it was Joseph in Essex and gave me permission to, like, you get to exist. You get validation for your existence in a way that I had not gotten validation. And so that's kind of how the title came on. So it was, it felt very serendipitous that it came to be being, because it was like, I do feel like there's so many elements of Joseph's work, and who knows what Joseph would have cultivated on this plane had they continued on this plane, because they are cultivating in other ways, right?
Right.
But I saw that as a pivotal part of the, like, the naming and the legacy, so.
I love that. Well, and I love it because already you speak to so many of the things that matter deeply to us, is complexity and getting to be with all the things we actually are, rather than trying to winnow and narrow ourselves down to some idealized version of ourselves, and ourselves in the collective, you know. It's like, why can't we all just be lockstep, you know, on this line? It's like, that's not how we are as a people. We are the result of generations of disorganizing, decentering, destabilizing, disembodying behaviors. And we are just landing back in our bodies with the teachers that we have available to us now. We are just now landing back into what does it mean to be Black with and beyond that trauma, that traumatizing constant state, which is still ongoing, you know? So I'm like, yes, it's so beautiful to then be like, of course we have that complexity. Of course we have many, many, many different modes of survival, which are at odds with each other. And it's beautiful to take the step to create an institution that can hold, or at least aim to hold all that, right?
That's it. There is the goal. Keyword is aim to hold.
And when did y'all come into existence, Beam?
We came into existence in 2016. So it's only been 4 years, but it feels like a lot.
What long. A 4 years though.
You know, because when the concept first came, you know, when we first kind of like talking the concept, and I was talking like to Erica Woodland and Kenya Bear, and of course, Moria God,
of course,
and many
of
others.
Course.
Hey, this is a thing that I think should exist. What does that mean? And so it's been such a journey, because, you know, initially people were like, didn't understand what it was, what was the necessity of it. And I think that the piece that I've also been really intentional with and struggle with is like, not just about what does it mean to create an institution that does this work, but also that embodies that work, right? And I think that's one thing that I don't get a chance to really talk about with people about, like the intentionality I put into certain pieces. So, you know, like when we started getting money, like making intentionality with how people are compensated, right? So I was, nobody at Beam is making less than $60,000. And like that's a period. We're going to get on a, so like when Beam gets hired, gets a certain amount of donations, guess what? People get bonuses. People were like, the first year I did that, people were like, what do you mean I'm getting a bonus? I'm like, no, because this is about building the black wealth for the staff who are here as well, but also about like, how do we even think about how money flows through institutions and how we give it to folks, right? And so it's about practicing and figuring out, how do I show up in the work with folks and challenge the urgency addiction of our partners and challenging like the white supremacy culture and struggling, right? And struggling with this. When like, you know, like in, I think the embodiment is an important piece too of like my hope and aim with Beam is not just to be, we do this work for other folks, but people who work at Beam being able to say that like, actually we do this work with each other every single day.
That's it right there. And how big is the team right now? And I noticed that it's like the Beam Collective. And I wondered about that a little bit. It's like, is it a very intentional collective process of functioning internally? Is it, you know, like some people use the term collective and it's like, is it, you know, like I'm just like, how is that playing out and how, at what scale right now?
Yeah, it's a great question because I think that people ask around it and never ask me directly about that piece. And I think my vision for it being a collective, because I think when we think about collective, we think about a particular operating structure, right? Like, consensus decision making, which makes it very difficult in a nonprofit structure, right? But like trying to implement that nonprofit structure is one of the aims. Like right now, we're working with the HR consulting firm, which I'm really trying to figure out how do we do this and also make this sustainable and real, a really radical, progressive HR structure. But as it is now, what it really formulates and kind of functions as is really just a collab, like me infusing or us infusing collaborative kind of like decision making as much as possible, collaborative like partnership and really having folks across the country. So we have our core staff, right, who are six of us, right, and then we have our national folks who are like a lot more than that, like said about seven folks who consistently. So people that Holiday, Tony Michelle does workshops with us, Natalie Patterson. Tanai and Wesley, who are our Reiki healers, who do Reiki every month, right? And those folks are a part of us. To me, it's a part of us. It's just as important as any staff person because, the capitalism teaches us that, like, oh, I don't, an organization doesn't own your labor. They're not as legitimately a part of your institution. I think I respect that. I say that, no, actually, we all are a part of each other's learning and making this possible and making this happen, right? So that's where we're at now in terms of our, and we're constantly growing and kind of inviting new people. And I'm just always kind of like thinking more about how can we not only revolutionize the ways in which like 501c3 structures operate, how do we do that in a way that's an integrity? And how do we also do that in a way that transitions us from that space and also deals with all the trauma that is uprooted when you try to transition into a collective space versus a traditional kind of nonprofit space? Because I think one thing we don't talk about enough is that, when folks, we have so much harm that has been done to us in collectives, grassroots, nonprofits, and sometimes we come in expecting the harm and looking for
Absolutely. We're like, I already have one job. Now I know what's going
it.
on.
And
How are you gonna hurt me?
so doing that work is a part of it too. So just like naming that as a critical work of doing that piece and like that space. So it's a project. It's a goal and
That's
it's a,
great.
and I think that there's been some great wins and there have definitely been some times in which I've failed, which is like a room for me to learn more about like how do I show up differently? What could I have done differently or what is the opportunity for me,
What do you feel like is one of your biggest lessons that you've learned in this 4 years?
I was gonna say the first thing I was gonna say, corporate like nonprofit corporations and white supremacy sucks. No, but like that's we know
I
that
mean,
already. We know that already. We know
it's different to be
that
face to face trying to lead through those waters, but yes.
Yeah. One of the things I've learned, and I'm trying to find a way to give language to these two different pieces. So one, I will say the urgency addiction of nonprofit is so toxic and so easily, you can easily kind of pass that over to other spaces. And countering that has been an incredible challenge for us, particularly as we've gotten more visible as an entity. Because people want everything from you right then and now. That's the easy one. The difficult one, I will say, and I think this is really clear, I think I haven't had a chance to talk about it as much as I do want to talk about it. Being a person who is, a non-binary person who's projected as a man and receives the enormity of social and psychological and structural privileges that men receive in this world, and being one of the only projected as men who was a person who's highly visible in healing justice and healing wellness work, right? And what that means in terms of like, yes, you are non-binary and when you come into this space, they hear you differently. They're going to listen to you differently. You have credibility in a different way, right? And holding that reality, along with my own reality of who I am, and also what that awakens for other folks, and that is legitimate, that is real, that is like, fuck that, that is real. Like, and so holding that piece, and also holding all the pieces of also that, I think interwoven in there sometimes is other stuff that isn't really about me or about these things. And trying to navigate holding all those pieces, I think that has been really difficult because, you know, when you're, there are things, and I'm sure you know this too, when people perceive you in a certain light, people stop saying no to you and stop telling you what they really feel often.
Absolutely.
And then you kind of get that around other ways and you're just like, wait, because now you become a projection that's larger than something else. Yeah. And it's not really who you are, but who you are that serves me, because it's something I'm just working through, which we all have and do in our lives.
Yes, yes. And it's the training, right? We get trained to celebritize and disconnect people from being human. Because, you know, I think of that as capitalism and at work is like, oh, now you are expected to do a different kind of labor for me, which is to carry my projections. Ooh, I'm like, Jesus. Oh, well, I didn't sign up for that and no one's paying me that kind of money. So you know, I'm going to keep doing me. But
for me, Adrian, is it like, yeah, we all project, but it's about like, how do I own that? And there are moments in which we all project and we don't realize we're projecting. And later on, we're like, that was a projection.
Yeah.
And so I think that that is a piece too, that like what happens is that like the larger people perceive you to be, or however people perceive you to be, those projections become so deeply cemented that it's like there's no more investment in who I am anymore, because it's so far from there. And that is hard, because it's navigating that's hard as a facilitator. It's like people come in and navigating is hard with intimacy, with like people being like, oh, I can't show up and we YOLO and be this and I can't be this, or navigating that is like YOLO thinks he did it XYZ, and it's like, whoa, and like the capacity to manage those things, the all those pieces, while also holding that, you know, we carry our own. I carry my own.
Yeah. But
that's been a difficult kind of place for me to intersect and navigate. And I feel like the culture hasn't been in a place where we can have that conversation as much as robustly as I would like around gender. I think we still talk about gender very much so from a external kind of like, we're not talking about those nuances of like, okay, well, I mean, I see little pockets of it, but I don't see a lot of conversation around like, hey, people see me and they think I'm a man.
And they're orienting around my, I think that's super, I love that you're raising this conversation, because I think one of the things that happens, you know, I experienced this for light skin privilege. I experienced this for my college education. I experienced this for other things where I'm like, oh, like, I don't necessarily experience that. You know, I experience hardships. Like I experience a lot of hardships and a lot of obstacles. And just because you're experiencing those doesn't mean you're not also benefiting from other people's projections of whatever privileges or proximity you have to power that they hold. And it absolutely shapes what can happen inside of the nonprofit industrial complex, which I think is huge. And I don't see enough leaders speak about what can move and not move and how you subvert some of those things. You know, for me, I'm like, okay, how do I constantly be partnering with people who have different privileges and different oppressions than myself? And then how do I share, like in a real way, share the direction, you know, like the political Ouija board work, you know, like how do I really make sure I'm not just pushing and driving with my access, but really letting all of our access and all of our needs come to the table. So I'm grateful that you brought that up. And I think it is complicated. And I keep having this thought keeps popping up in the side of my brain. So I'm just gonna say it to you, maybe we'll leave it in, maybe not. But I think about how, like when Kanye got famous, all of a sudden, all that he wanted to rap about was like the problems that come with being famous, and how it's like, Kanye, like no one else is famous. Like, please make music that we can still relate to. But then when you do start to have that shift in how you're being perceived, how you're being seen, or how your work is being seen, right? Because it's like Beam is all over the place now. It's like, it feels like it's grown exponentially. Like in the 4 years that it's existed, it's been 4 years where it was so needed that it has really been able to grow quickly. And so there's that funny thing of like, where do you have the conversation around challenging celebrity culture, challenging those norms inside of the industrial complexes, and challenging really fame, right? But without boring all the people who are like, that's not the most relevant conversation, except we do want to hold you accountable for fucking up. You know, like I'm like, oh, dang. how do we do this? You know? So
it's a curious phenomenon, because I think about this a lot, thinking about like, you know, background and as an astrologer, like, you know, doing that kind of work, and what it means, and what it means when you see certain people, you know. Uh-huh. So like there is something that me as an astrologer will never deny about looking at Madonna and Prince's chart, that this person's going to take up a lot of space in the world, right? Like you can't look at that and say that, right? You get, like, for me to be like, oh, and so it's like, okay, this, but how does capitalism use that, right? Like, you know what I mean? What does that be? And what does that look like without capitalism, right? Like, what does that look like? Like, there are folks who have come into the world, and I'm not saying that I'm one of them, because I'm not trying to be nowhere near that.
I mean,
but I'm not trying to be, but like, what does it mean? Like, how do we hold that there are people like, you know, a Prince, an Audrey, who are just destined to bring those pieces in, but how do we also intercede and stop capitalism from doing these things, mm-hmm. like dehumanizing them, overpowering them, right? Like, you know what I mean? With certain pieces. And what does that look like? And I think that's something that I'm always constantly in question about, even with the power that I hold. And I think that, it's difficult for me, because I think that, like, people often are expecting certain things. And when I invite, and so one of the things I try to practice to do, and it's not even like I try to, it's kind of like my natural nature as a country kind of bumpkin person, is always like, come play, right, everybody right, come right. play, everybody come play and hang out. And, you know, some people don't receive that as that. They receive it as, wait, you know, like, or like, you know, and I'm just like, no, come play, we got this. You know, I grew up in a very country bumpkin family, and my, like, you know,
yes, bumpkin. I mean, it is a country bumpkin thing to even say country bumpkin.
Fun.
That, you just proved it.
And so I think that's a part of what I always hope for Beam, is that Beam just really uplifts the brilliance of so many folks, not saying it's just us, but saying, hey, like, let's shine a spotlight around and
that's
like
it, right,
shine
there.
It and give the wealth and the support. And because that's what I grew up seeing my father do, who grew up really, really poor, who now is not so poor and is constantly doing that, right? And I think that, like, for me, it's like, how do we do that? How do we give that back or redistribute?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the way to navigate it, is to figure out, like, you know, how can I be the moon, right? Like, I'm always like, okay, how can I be reflecting whatever is the best light towards the places where it's most needed, and to be pulling the most powerful waves towards the shore, right? Like, how can I be the moon? And I see that for me, one of the answers of how you do that is to really be on purpose, but also able to adapt to what your community is actually telling you is needed. And, you know, that can happen in lots of different ways. So for Emergent Strategy, it's like, oh, the community says they need immersive space to learn how to do this. We're doing that. The community says they need facilitation training. Great. Let's figure out how we do that. Like, the community actually wants, you know, this, that. And I would love to hear how, over this past 4 years, and even now, where it's been a period of immense Black trauma, but also immense Black organizing and victory and moves and overextension and burning out and all, I mean, like, it's been a huge time where Black people have been center stage, claiming the attention of the nation and the world. Look at the trauma and also look at our solutions. And I wonder what adaptations have been required from Beam in order to stay relevant to the Black community.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The first thing that comes to mind is, and this is probably some of my own kind of internalized, like, socialization stuff that kind of, like, initially created this frame. You know, when Beam was kind of created, it was thought a training institution, and we still are primarily mm-hmm. a training institution. We do a lot of public and private training around, like, how to hold space and all these pieces. But when the pandemic hit, you know, what ended up happening is a lot more requests were like, yeah, we need skills, but we just need y'all to hold space.
Yes.
We need y'all to
somebody hold us. Me. Yes.
Right, exactly. You know, which was for me, like, okay, is that going to be, you know, is that enough? Is that mm-hmm. sustainable? Is that good enough? Because when there are things, I have the privilege of being in a community with folks who do that kind of intrinsically holding space for
right.
folks. So I forget how that is not something other folks always have access to,
right.
you know? And so, you know, there was, I remember that we started, me and Natalie started doing Heart Space, which is our Black peer support group space, right? Beautiful. And now we're doing them, like, we do it publicly twice a week, but we also have done it for, like, the Black folks at Netflix who are like, please come and do this. We have
really Black folks at yes.
We have all these folks, and it's a really simple structure. I tell people all the time, it's like, we lead with a meditation, a grounding, we, you know, talk about feelings and boundaries, and then we just open up with two check-in questions. And the Beautiful. Check-in questions are like, what's keeping you rooted? What do you need to give yourself permission to feel?
Yes.
And when I tell you, it's funny because me and Natalie look back on it. We're like, if somebody would have told us this was the thing that, because you know, the internalized capitalism is like, we got to do an extra special training on the something. And they were like, no, actually,
basic.
Hold space for us. Let access really question that allows us to check in what we're feeling in our bodies and our spirit. And let's be in presence with each other virtually or whatever, however we can. Right. And I think that was a big, like, oh, okay, like this is going against my internalized capitalism, which says this isn't hard enough work.
Yes,
just hold space, you know what I mean? That's like, right. It needs to be more rigorous to be legit. Waves love, waves love, waves love, waves love, waves love, waves love, waves love. This is for Shetty R. Dedicate this with a heavy heart.
I love that distinction. I think about this all the time, that I'm like, what would it look like if everyone leaned towards the thing that actually came naturally to them and was given full permission to bring that to their community, whether it was facilitation and healing, whether it was holding space, whether it was song, whether it was doula work, whether it was playing with the kids, taking care of the kids, cooking, whatever it is. And I think when I look at my vision for the future, a lot of times that's really what it is. Like when I think, when we talk about emergent strategy visions for the future, a lot of it is, there's room for everyone to bring their best self to the table, and not in a transactional way, but because it's joyful to do so. It's joyful to give what you have to give. And I love hearing that the beam is up to that joyfulness, right? That aligned playing your position, right? So a question I hold for you is, Black movement spaces are struggling for lots of reasons. One of the biggest, you know, we've talked about capitalism in a lot of different ways, but one of the biggest, I think, is still the impact of philanthropy, which too often still pits us against each other for limited resources rather than encouraging us to collaborate to make the most of what we have. But we're also struggling because we're under such an inundation of constant traumatic experiences. And, you know, we get trained in strategy more than we get trained in, like, how to be in right relationship with each other. So I want to ask you, as someone, you know, who is providing these kind of networks and trainings and spaces for people, what resources do you and does Beam think we most need to develop in and for Black movement spaces?
This is so just an interesting question. I'm going to tell you why. Like, Adrian, you're pulling something that you might be sensing that has been my secret baby project, but not secret baby project.
Yes.
But,
secret baby projects. Those are my favorite.
Like, is that Go-Go Gadget? That's what Go-Go Gadget. The
Power Rangers. Everybody's always like, which one is that? Is that Hot Pocket?
I love that.
And I'm like, sorry. Okay.
so one, for me, one of the things that I was often been frustrated with historically in my work with nonprofits is seeing how much extra additional money was just kind of buttressed in spaces where I'm just like, this should be going to community. This really, I'm not here for this. I'm not here for nonprofits who supposed to serve community. They're like, we got a $15 million. No, not while people out here are eating, sis. That's not it. No. That's not it. That's not it. That's not it.
Yeah.
So we with, like, you know, in QSIN and Beam have the Southern Healing Support Fund, right? So we started with that piece, like really focusing on the rural South, folks who were doing amazing work. And that started off with, you know, funding doulas who were doing birth work. Maya Peak Wellness in Memphis, Tennessee, we supported them with doing a prenatal doula yoga retreat, right? Beautiful, power, like 50 folks there, all with child, like gorgeous, right?
That's right.
We support Lorenzo Lewis and his amazing work educating barbers about Black mental health and having less stigmatizing conversations. And then we went to support community gardens. And so really want to expanding that piece. But one piece that really speaks to this question that I have felt very strongly about has been a collaboration that I've been working with, and it's not private anymore, but like with Tanisha McCarris, Will Cordery, Renee from Philanthropy Unbound, is what I'm calling, or what we're calling, the Black Wellness Innovation Fund.
Yes.
And what we're saying is that, like, right now we're in this moment where there is all this distress happening in our communities, and a lot of money is going towards racial justice organizing, as it should. And there's more money that needs to be used and given to Black-led wellness innovation and wellness spaces, right? So, like, when beautiful. I think about what, like, I see struggling, what I see movement and other spaces struggling with, it's just like really more spaces to be able to hold wellness for folks, and actually being able to afford to have people come in and collectively support that wellness in certain spaces, right? And so what does it mean if we have a national fund that actually is dedicated to only Black-led, innovative, non-criminal and engaged in wellness practice, so like it's not connected to the criminal legal system, right? The stuff that we know our folks are already doing, and like just bolstering it and uplifting it, which is a big part of what my hope and heart is to do in the world. That is, I feel like we need more resources for our folks to do more of that work. Because the reality is, when I think about when Beam first started approaching funders, and like, you know, people were, I had to explain like everything from healing justice to what, well, like, you know, all those pieces, they had clue.
Oh yeah.
Now we're in a different little bit of a space, thanks to the work of like Karen Page and many folks, right?
The landscape,
but we need more resources. And so that's a project that I've been kind of on my high horse with, and we've been, you know, building, and we'll see more probably in the next coming year about us publicly raising those funds, is because we're like, this needs to exist as an entity, a funders collaborative, that you all need to be giving this money to our communities and to our folks indefinitely in this way. So that's something I've been thinking about, and like for the futures, for Black futures, really, you know what I mean?
That's great. I love that. And, you know, I love the idea, like we keep thinking about the same thing, is like, how do we resource things so that they're available to the community without the community having to figure out how to hustle to get them? And you know, we are working, you and I, we Beam and ESII are working together to basically make sure that mediation is available to Black folks who need it. And I keep thinking of more and more things like that. Like, how can we dedicate resources, generate resources so that people are like, I just need support, I just need help. And I need to know A, where to turn to, that is B, skilled enough to answer this call, and C, has the capacity to do so. And I love the idea that it's like, well, it's just in community, you know, everybody do it for free. But I'm also like, and there's gifts and skills, and we need to talk about gifts and skills. And, you know, there's people I know, myself included, there's people I know who are like, I would love to have money out of the equation completely. Like when I get the call to heal, I just want to be able to show up to heal and not have to think about that. And it's taken years of training and people being like, but girl, you're worth, but girl, like, it's okay to value your time or to value the offer. And what I deeply recognize is when people come and they don't have resources, it's not because they don't value the offer, right? It's because every structure in place is designed so that we don't have the resources to access healing and access our wellness. So I'm really grateful that you're generating those resources and moving in that direction. And I guess my broader question for you, and we're almost at the end, so we're like, I like to go bigger. So my next sort of broadening question is, do you have a vision for what it looks like when Black people are living healed lives, living in healed community? How will you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if healed as a destination we ever reach. I'm not sure if I'm able to even conceptualize that. And I also worry about how that term can be used sometimes, even though I know that in healing justice space, we use it differently, but sometimes it can invoke these really deeply kind of ableist fears and anxieties around like how they talk about
right, life. Like perfection of self or something.
Mm-hmm. And so like, you know, one of the quotes that I try to like, I've been holding on to in terms of how I understand healing is like, you know, it's a journey and a relationship to our psychological and emotional selves that centers tenderness and liberation and not an ableist vision of being, right? But
yes,
I think about more about communities that, like, what is my hope for community, Black communities that center healing, that center the practice of healing? So centering it doesn't mean that you always get it right. It means that you mess up.
That's right.
We didn't do this and we did it. And I think that that's really my hope, is to help cultivate more of that coming into existence with the tenderness and the compassion. And there's a lot of ways I see that looking. Like, one of the biggest pieces I see that is, I see just a dramatic shift in how emotional labor is held in Black spaces. I see not Black women, not just Black feminine folks holding all of the emotional labor. And I also want to hold that, like, you know, as somebody who holds a lot of emotional labor and has been invited to stop holding emotional labor, that is a lot easier said than done. People are like, let go. It's like, because when you're accustomed to that and using that as a method, which I know I have, as avoiding my own stuff, it can be difficult.
So you're saying I should just stop helping these people and go cry? Oh, fuck you. I don't think so.
Changing that so that non-binary folks, masculine folks, men folks are doing their emotional labor but holding theirs, but understanding that, like, when that looks like it won't look, sometimes people say that those things, it's like the idea that it's going to look like in this kind of like perfect way, because it's going to look different. Because as somebody who's worked with men and masculine folks, it's like, if you have lived all your life, 40 years of your life, and you haven't had an opportunity to cultivate those muscles, you're going to move differently in that than somebody who's 40 years of their life been in it because of the culture's forced them in it, or because that's their work. And so we have to really talk about ableism in that too. Like, even when we talk about the ways in which men or masculine folks or people with different cognitive neurocognitive show up emotionally, it's not going to be the same way this cis person, able-bodied person, is going to be able to process and move through emotions, right? So holding all of that is going to be, I think, a murky point for us to figure out and tease through. Is a redistribution of emotional labor, holding accountability. It's about responsibility. Like, you know, my friend, you know, Channy talks about all the time. Channy's like, YOLO, my sun, Mercury, and Jupiter are all Saturn. So, like, I'm responsible for everything. And I'm also like, and I'm always like, responsibility. Everybody have responsibility.
Everybody. Come on.
And I think that, like, a place where we can take a culture where we can take responsibility for how our behavioral ideas show up for folks in a way that isn't rooted in shame, in a way that, like, heals, in a way that, like, lifts up. And, like, I'm thinking about those pieces of practices that I want to see. So I would say distribution of emotional labor, you know, that piece around, like, shame and accountability. Also a piece around just accessibility, like, where just people can get access to anything they need in their tool belt, whether that tool belt includes yoga, Reiki, you know, like botanicals, whether it includes, like, you know, medication, like really having access to those things in a way that loving and cautious and measured, because anything can become, any tool can become a problem. Like I tell people all the time, like, you know, depending on how we relate to it.
Yeah.
Is my real hope. And just for safe, for increased commitment to collective safety.
I love it. I love all that. Thank you. Thank you. Because I do think I feel like I work all the time not to be outcome oriented. And I also think about states of being, right? And I think about the Black state of being as hypervigilant for generations. And what would it look like to be in a different state of being? Where healing was available and safety was available to us. And so we could let down whatever that is that holds us up and tight and in, and we could let that down and out, not just when we're singing and dancing and celebrating each other, which we do, but just sitting in the home, you know, with our children, being able to be fully relaxed. And I see that in what you just painted for us. So last question, who are your teachers right now? Who are your teachers?
Interesting. I feel like I'm getting some new teachers, actually. One of my teachers, well, first of all, I feel like the collective that I work with, the folks I'm in community with, are always teaching me. I'm learning through them. I've learned from one colleague who let me know that YOLO, you don't give direct statements. You ask, can you, as opposed to just saying, you want me. And like
Libra much.
Libra all day, right? Libra. Libra. Can you please do this? As opposed to like,
can you please get out my face?
Listen, it's real. Like, I know. People come to me and sometimes they want to be like, oh, we're going to do a training on codependency. I'm like, I'm a Libra, so I don't need this training. But if I don't want to do this training, people need support here.
Go help y'all people. I'm good.
So I think that some of my teachers are always people I'm in collaboration with and community with. They teach me how to be present, how to listen, how to take responsibility, how to see when I'm being activated and how that's driving me and moving.
Great.
I think they're big teachers. Some of my other teachers that constantly in my life, you know, I lift up Ulester Douglas, who is a social worker, Black feminist, man who taught me so much of what I know in terms of how to show up in the world and how to acknowledge all the depths of ways in which male socialization impacts my life and learn about all the ways that I think it does and it does, right? Like, you know, and so it's really been just somebody who's really powerful in my life. And then all my Reiki teachers, Wesley and Tanai, they are Reiki teachers. They've been trying to get me into school, but they practice with me and they've been teaching me sessions, which has been really helpful, both for my healing, beautiful, but also to learn more. So those are some folks. And then the last piece I would say, my Miles and my Marley, who are my nephew and my niece, who teach me.
So beautiful.
I don't think I've ever loved beings with so much in the way that I love them. And I understand, I can imagine what parents must feel, because I have both this deep love and I want to protect them from everything in the world. And I'm horrified of the world. Like I understand that now in a different way that I did not when I'm with them and the preciousness they bring to me. And so I feel like they teach me a different dimension of vulnerability than I think I've ever known, to be honest with you, because they're just my little babies, my boos. So yeah, those are some of my teachers, I would say.
Thank you so much for this conversation. And we will put Beam information in the show notes so that those who are listening can go check y'all out, check out your programs. Thank you, YOLO, for sharing your miraculous and precious time with us. And thank you, listeners, for tuning into this conversation. Thank you. Have a beautiful everything.
This podcast is produced by Natalie Parrott. Music for the Emergent Strategy podcast is provided by Complex Movements, a Detroit-based artist collective. The music provided is from the soundtrack of the performance installation, Beware of the Dandelions. To support the ongoing work of ESII, make a donation at www.alliedmedia.org/ESII.